Okay, good morning. We'll get started now. So, last time we presented a fairly basic representation of a digital communications system model. And so we had a number of components, a message source, which we primarily, for the moment, assume to be a voice signal. That signal has to be digitized in some way, since it's obviously an analog signal to begin with. And so we looked at basic pulse code modulation, so sampling at 8,000 samples per second, and digitizing each of those samples with 8 bits per sample. And we said that that gave us a fairly good recreation of our voice signal. We then looked at source encoding, which the aim of which is to further compress our signal. So in order to sort of get the maximum efficiency, the maximum amount of information sent, we may wish to sort of represent our signals using less bits than traditional. And again, we had a look at various voice encoding techniques, which allowed us to send lower bit rate streams to represent our voice signal. We then looked at channel encoding. We didn't say a whole lot about this. We'll return to it in a very specific form later in term. But the basic idea of channel encoding is to add some redundancy to our basic signal to help combat error in the channel. Okay, so it's hopefully to recover from error, if not to recover, to at least detect the error. So we up to here we have a sequence of bits, and those bits have to be sort of represented in some way that they can be transmitted, and that the representation of bits using a sinusoidal waveform is what's known as modulation. And so we saw that with modulation you could vary your amplitude, phase, and frequency. And as we went through all of these, we had a look at what impact various components had on performance characteristics of the system. So your basic error rate for the system, so what's your likelihood of misinterpreting a bit. Your bandwidth efficiency, so what bit rate can you pack into a specific bandwidth, and how those interplayed with each other. Okay. The component of the system that we left off was the actual radio channel. So again, we're dealing with wireless technology. We have a radio transmitter sending our signal. So what we're going to do today is look at the characteristics of this radio channel. And again, what we'll see as we go along is sort of how it differs from wireless and why it's sort of a bit more problematic to deal with. Okay, so for today, again, a good bit of what I'm saying is in Chapter 5 of William Stallings, but loads of other sort of wireless communications textbooks will sort of tell you the same things. what we're going to look at today. I'm going to say just a very, very, very few words on antennas and antenna types. The thing to take away from that is just that, you know, there are various designs of antennas for different purposes within a radio system. So what you have in your mobile phone is going to be slightly different totally different from what's at the base station. Okay. But having said that, they all have a few basic characteristics. We can abstract away all the details and just look at a few basic formulas which will describe what we need to know about antennas, which is typically just sort of the power at which they send and receive signals. Okay. Then, from then on, really, we're looking at the characteristics of the signals as they travel over a distance. And again, this gets a good bit more complicated than for wired signals. For wired signals, we usually leave it at, you know, the signal attenuates, and so we have to fix the distance of our wire and then sort of recreate the signal, or at least boost the signal. For wireless or radio transmission, exactly how the signal is deteriorating is quite complex. And it's dependent on some sort of big properties, what's called large-scale fading, which just has to do with the distance of the between the sender and the receiver, and then, sadly, not only the distance, but what sort of terrain there is in between the sender and the receiver. Okay. And then we also have small-scale effects, which means that, so you have, you know, the sender and the receiver are, you know, yards away, miles away, whatever. But as the sender moves, or even as the things around the sender, or as the mobile unit moves, or even things around the mobile unit moves over very small distances, again, the characteristics of the channel change. Okay. So the bottom line is that it becomes very difficult to predict globally exactly what the characteristics of your systems are. And so what we're going to do is have a look at, again, all of the sort of basic categories of effects that can impact on your radio channel. And we're also going to note that, in general, what this boils down to, this can boil down to two things. When we move on and start looking at cellular systems, we actually abstract away from a lot of this, and we abstract it into just a distance formula, so the channel varies with distance. But again, a lot of people put a lot of effort into studying the very specific characteristics of channels and sort of in sort of specific configurations in order to sort of optimize, you know, indoor, in this setting, in that setting, how you send your signal.
Excuse me. The distance itself is a factor, or because of the resistance or deterioration of the
distance is a factor.
It is. It's,
yes.
Even if there is no loss.
There's what, well, if you hold on for a second, not too long, we'll go through the antennas, but there's what's called free space loss, which means no matter what, no matter where you are, you're out in space, your signal still attenuates with distance. So yeah, no matter what, distance is a factor. And that is, that's again, free space loss, and we'll consider that sort of first as one of the primary causes of the signal power loss. Okay. So, again, the device, the mechanism by which radio signals are transmitted and received is an antenna. And so the idealized version of an antenna is what's called an isotropic antenna. And we assume that an isotropic antenna can transmit a signal equally in all directions at some power level T. Okay. So there's some spherical ball of power as you move away from the antenna. Okay. So this power level is fixed to some unit distance away from the antenna, and we can characterize the mean radiation density at that distance, and then again along a surface of a sphere at that distance from the antenna, you have the same radiation density at all points. Okay, so the power level is moving out from the antenna. Okay, and again, what we're doing is we're right here, we're characterizing sort of the transmission power level, so the essentially the power level at the antenna. Again, as it moves, that changes. Okay, now in actuality, you can't build an antenna that just radiates in all directions. You can build approximations of that sort of antenna, no problem, but not something that radiates spherically at uniform density. And indeed, we might not even want to. We may actually want to point our antenna in a specific direction. If we're sending to a fixed location, again, it's better to aim at where you're sending. Okay. So the directivity of an antenna is just an indication of how the power is concentrated in a specific direction. Okay. And it's defined as the maximum power density over the mean power density. Okay. And so again, it's just an indication of how we're focusing power in a single direction. As a note, again, if you're dealing with real antennas, not all of the input power actually goes towards transmitting a signal, but part of it's going to be converted into heat and dissipated in other forms. And again, if you are trying to send it in a direction, only a fraction of it's actually going in the direction you want, maybe a large fraction. Okay, so what you can get is something this order. So instead of having your spherical radiation of power, you have the radiation concentrated in a specific direction. And but even when you do this, usually you have some power going in directions that you don't want. Okay, so it's not like you can send it all exactly where you want it. And exactly how much goes where is dependent on the design of the antenna. So, again, for our purposes, all we're going to do is note that there's lots of different ways to design antennas, and lots of and these antennas sort of fulfill very specific purposes. Okay. Again, if you have a mobile, you obviously are sort of restricted in terms of size, et cetera. So you typically would have what's called a microstrip patch antenna that can fit on the device. When you're talking about base stations, you will have larger antennas and capable of transmitting at greater power, and also capable of broadcasting either omnidirectionally or in a sectorized fashion, or even point to point. Okay. And again, this omnidirectional is slightly different than our, again, ideal antenna, in the sense that this would actually be sort of radiating out cylindrically, not spherically, from the antenna. Okay. And so we'll see when we get to, again, to the design of cellular, the basic cellular architecture, where we might want to be able to start looking at omnidirectional antennas, and then we'll see that in some cases it makes sense to sectorize the antennas. Again, we'll see why. Okay. Point-to-point might occur in things like broadband to the home, if you're trying to get something to a very specific, a fixed location, or point-to-point communication. Okay, one common type of antenna is a dipole antenna, and they're built from a length of wire, a half wavelength long, and they don't radiate from the ends, so again, they'll give you a sort of a donut shape or a cylindrical shape out from the antenna, which gives you omnidirectional transmission within a plane. Now, these antennas are often used as baselines because they can be built, unlike sort of again your generic omnidirectional antenna, and other antennas' behavior can be normalized to these instead. And again, within these dipole antennas, what we can see here is just that you can get a fair approximation, again, of an omnidirectional antenna, or again, a 360 degree radiation pattern. And so what we see here is, depending on the wavelength or the length of the antenna, you get patterns, and these would be cross sections. Okay, so another common sort of antenna would be parabolic antennas. And these are quite handy for directionality, because again, they will concentrate the signal in a direction sort of parallel to the antenna, perpendicular to the antenna. And so here, if you're transmitting, again, what you see is because of the shape of the curve, everything ends up, all of the power is radiated out parallel, in a parallel direction, so very directionally. And similarly, if you're coming in, it's going to all be concentrated at a focal point. Okay. And this is just, again, due to the geometric properties of the of the parabola. Okay, so again, for directional antennas, gain refers to the power output in a specific direction compared to the power output you would get if you used an omnidirectional antenna. And similarly, at the receiver, it's the gain in the received signal relative to an if you have an omnidirectional antenna as a receiver. Okay, so this gain function is a function of the size and shape of the antenna, and this is captured in what's called the effective area of an antenna. And so we have our gain formulas, 4 pi times the effective area over lambda squared. Now, again, for our purposes, the main thing to carry away from this is just that antennas do come with gain factors attached, so that when we're talking about power transmitted and power received, that frequently will have to be the gain factor will have to be accounted for in that. And so we will be inserting it into our equations as we go along through the lecture. So that tells you almost nothing about how antennas work. They're interesting things, but it's not what we need for this, for what we're intending to do. Again, we're just going to assume that we can characterize our antennas very simply through this gain characteristic. Okay, so having said that, we're going to spend essentially the rest of the lecture talking about the propagation of signals through a distance and what factors impact on how the signals are received at at a receiver. So it's possible for a radio signal to travel in one of three ways. Ground waves follow the contours of the Earth, and these are used typically in AM radios, and they can travel a long distance, mainly because you don't have to worry about line of sight. Okay. Sky waves bounce between the Earth's surface and the ionosphere, and again, because of this bouncing, they travel over a large distance. The mode that is used in wireless communications is what's called line of sight. And again, above 30 megahertz, have to use it. And it generically means exactly that. The signal travels from point A to point B, and you have to have along a straight line. So if that straight line is obstructed, potentially you cannot receive your signal. We'll see later that that's not quite true, because you can get bouncing off of other objects and maybe eventually get where you want to go. But in general, we assume that we have a clear path. Okay. So, our transmission is not going over any distance, is not going to be received exactly as it was transmitted. The signal will attenuate, so the signal diminishes in power, and potentially we can get distortions of the signal as well, which means that along different frequencies that it's diminishing at different rates. Now, the causes of the attenuation and the distortion, well, the first one we're going to examine is free space loss. And as I said a minute ago, free space loss means that even if you're out in space with no obstructions, no nothing, no atmosphere, your signal still diminishes. Okay. It just diminishes in a nice, predictable fashion. We're not in space, so just being in the atmosphere is going to introduce various noise factors and atmospheric absorption, which again will diminish our signal further. And that's even if we have an unobstructed view from point A to point B. And finally, because of our surroundings, we're not just again in the middle of nowhere. Our signal tends to not just go along our line of sight, our straight path, but it tends to reflect off of objects and maybe bend around objects, etc. And so what you end up with is a single signal will arrive into the sender over multiple paths, multiple directions. Okay. And again, the combination then of all of those sort of received portions can serve to either increase or decrease the strength of the signal. And finally, what we'll see is that that becomes even worse when we start talking about mobility, that these changes can occur very rapidly as you're moving. Okay. So all of these factors affect the power at which you need to transmit the system. And again, there's a lot of work that goes on to trying to predict exactly how much power, what's the power difference between sender and receiver. And it's a very complex problem. Okay. And so there's mathematical models and there's empirical models, and they're often very focused on specific situations. So we refer to the reduction in power of a transmitted signal relative to as received by a receiver as fading, and again the influence of the factor influencing the amount of this reduction is the positioning of the sender versus the receiver, the transmitter versus the receiver. And this is dependent on, in the first case, the distance between the transmitter and the receiver, and also interference caused by interactions with the atmosphere and the terrain. And I should say, finally, it's also impacted by mobility. So the speed at which the sender is moving, or sorry, the speed at which the mobile station is moving, or again, even if there are changes within the terrain and the speed of those. Okay. Now, in terms of just trying to sort of categorize all the possible effects that we have, the first categorization is we talk about either large scale or small scale fading. Okay. Large scale fading is the effects due to relatively large distances between the transmitter and receiver. And small scale fading, and then again, is what happens when the mobile unit is moving a small amount. So we have small changes in these distances, but they can have fairly large impact on the signal itself. Okay. And again, we'll look at a few first factors influencing large-scale fading and try and get a handle on those. And then we'll look at the factors influencing small-scale fading, which again, these are quite complex. So we'll look at a few examples and just mention a few others. Okay. So again, the factors that we have to consider when comparing a signal at the sender versus the receiver are, first of all, attenuation. And this is going to be a function of the distance between sender and the receiver. And what you want to do is have a signal strength that is strong enough to overcome attenuation, but not so much that you're either going to overwhelm the received circuitry, not as much of a problem in wireless systems, or indeed, if you're talking about transmitting from a mobile station, there are power constraints and battery concerns. Okay, so you want to be able to determine what's just strong enough to get your signal there and get it interpreted properly. Okay, and potentially signals can be distorted if attenuation occurs differently at different frequencies, and if your signal is going to span over multiple frequencies. Okay, we'll return to this more when we're talking about the small scale fading. Okay, so the first effect that we look at for large-scale fading is free space loss. And again, this is just the idea that your signal attenuates no matter what. No matter where you are, what your environment, the signal still attenuates by a certain amount. And the amount by which your signal attenuates is d squared, the distance from the sender to the receiver. So we have our basic formula for free space losses, 4 pi d squared over, and here we have to account for the gains in the receiving and transmitting antenna. And the greater the gain, obviously, the less loss you have in your received signal relative to your transmitted signal. And then finally, it is also a function of the wavelength lambda. Okay. And so we can characterize that either with our gains, or again, we can use our effective areas and come up with the formulation relative to the effective area. Okay, so we have this relation between the received power and the transmitted power, and we frequently discuss the loss of the system, and the free space path loss is just the ratio of the received signal to the transmitted signal. And commonly, again, we might discuss this in decibel terms. Okay. And so the final four components of the decibel equation represent the loss in the system. And so we have terms for our free space loss, and here also we can add, one nice thing about decibels is that you can then start adding additional loss terms easily. And here we've added atmospheric loss as well. Okay. Okay. So again, the power is going to be proportional to the distance squared, or the drop in power is proportional to the distance squared. And frequently, again, we can get rid of all these gain factors, etc. If we normalize that to power at a fixed distance. Okay. So here we have our a standard reference distance d0. We measure the power there, and then we can define the power at any further distance relative to this normalized power. Okay. So it varies with d squared. And there are some conventions for picking D. It has to be far enough away from the antenna for, again, these rules to apply generally. Okay. So, again, the takeaway point from free space loss is that power is dropping as D squared. Again, there are additional factors that are going to impact on the power loss. Again, we've already discussed the sources, major categories for noise. Within the atmosphere, we have thermal noise. And again, we're going to have to send a sufficient power to overcome thermal noise. We have intermodulation noise. Just spill over between the bands of different frequencies, interference between multiple signals, and impulse noise, so just the spikes in noise that sort of obliterate signals entirely. Okay. And so the effects, again, of noise are captured in either the signal-to-noise ratio or the EB over N0. Okay. So, again, we're going to have to transmit a high enough power to overcome the effects of the noise within the system. So, free space loss says that our signal deteriorates that the power of our signal deteriorates as d squared, no matter what. And unfortunately, there's usually quite a few watts as well. Okay. And so, if we think about a scenario where we have, you know, a base station and some mobile unit, the base station again has to transmit fairly omnidirectionally. We'll assume it's omnidirectional for a moment, just to be able to sort of account for the mobile unit moving. And so it's transmitting a signal out in a lot of different directions. And that signal potentially bounces off portions of the terrain. And so at our receiver, and again, this transmission is sort of going both directions, whether the mobile unit or the base station is transmitting, so it doesn't matter which really. You don't get one copy of your signal. So you don't get, you know, what we think of initially as this line of sight signal, but we get multiple copies of the same signal. Okay. And the problem is that because of the distances being different, that these different copies are traveling, it's not exactly the same thing being received.
So how the mobile will differentiate between the real and the copy, or the first one and the second, which is...
You can try to do that, or you can just sort of, again, take the aggregate of the signals and deal with them. And typically what happens is you just sort of take the aggregates and deal with them. We'll talk a little bit about other things at the end. Okay. So, one of the main effect that we're going to examine within this is just you'll have multiple copies of these signals, and they'll all be, you know, somewhat out of phase with each other. So they're either reinforcing or canceling the original. Each copy sort of either increases or decreases the amplitude of the original signal. If the path lengths vary far enough, we get a second problem in that, again, when you talk about enforcing or not the original signal, you're assuming that you're referring to the same bit. Now, if the path lengths are sufficiently different, then the signal may be delayed longer than your bit transmission time. And if the signal's delayed longer than your bit transmission time, you're not comparing copies of the same signal, essentially, you have different signals, and you get inter-signal, inter-symbol interference. Okay. And so, yeah, this is just a fairly simple example of what we're talking about here. We have our direct path between our sender and our receiver, our base station and our mobile unit, and we're sending a sequence of bits from the base station to the mobile unit. But in addition to our direct path, there's a mountain somewhere off in the distance, and the signal's bouncing off the mountain. Okay. And so, because of the distances involved, we're quite close in one case and far away in the other case. Again, the arrival of the bits along the second path, bouncing off the mountain, is significantly delayed from the arrival of the bits along the direct path. And so essentially you're not receiving two copies of the same signal at a phase from each other. You're receiving different signals. Okay. And basically what that means is that this signal along the second path is always has to be considered to be interference. Okay, it can never actually be in any way considered to be correct or good. Okay. Okay, so multipath is actually not all bad. It helps in urban areas in particular. Because it may actually be difficult to have line of sight transmission. So, because, you know, if you're driving through New York City and you've got all these big buildings, you know, you might not always be able to sort of have a direct path between the sender and the receiver, the mobile unit and the base station. But because there's loads of things for the signal to bounce off of and reflect off of, some version of the signal is going to get from sender to receiver. There's no line of sight, but there's a lot of different reflected paths. Okay. And so we receive a signal, but again, the strength of that signal is probably deteriorating. It's something greater than D squared. Okay. So now we have this much more complicated picture. We have, say, a base station here at the top corner and a mobile station at the bottom corner, and a number of different paths by which the signal can go from base station to mobile station. And again, what you see in this case is that there is no line of sight path. There's things in the way of line of sight. Okay. but we have reflection, so the signal can sort of bounce off of various objects. We have another phenomenon called diffraction, which means the signal curves around objects. So if it's fairly, it's almost line of sight, you can occasionally get distortion around interfering objects. And you have scattering, where a signal also sort of reflects in multiple directions at weaker power. Okay. So, our first salvo into dealing with this is just to say that the effect of the above is that we have a further reduction in signal strength and potentially inter-symbol interference. Okay. And what we'd sort of ideally like to get back to is somehow quantifying that in terms of what we did before, the distance between the sender and the receiver. And so quite often we'll do exactly that. We'll say that our power loss is characterized as being some power of D, where D is, again, this distance. And that power of D is somewhere between 2 and typically 5.5. Okay.
Is that 7 or 2? 3 to the power of 7? No.
That's gamma.
Okay.
So that's this factor, which is variable. We don't actually know what it is.
Okay.
That factor is dependent on exactly where you are relative to all of the interfering objects. Okay, so to try and get a feel for this factor gamma, we're going to look at two different approaches. Again, it's an incredibly complex problem. The first one is we're just going to look at a two-path problem. Essentially, we're going to assume that we've got our line of sight signal, and then we've got a signal that bounces off the ground. Okay, so two paths. And with just two paths, we can do a quick mathematical analysis of what happens to the power ratio relative to distance. After that, what we're going to do is talk about various attempts to model power loss, and which are based on empirical studies. And, you know, again, typically what they want to know is if I'm in the middle of a city, what sort of power losses am I likely to experience? And so the way you do that is you go into a city and you start measuring things, and you try and decide what factors influence that and come up with some characterization based on that. Okay. So we'll look at it in those two contexts. We'll do a little bit of maths, and then we'll talk about empirical modeling. Okay. So our first example, and yeah, picture's probably not quite right in terms of the reflection, but close enough. We're assuming that we've got our transmitter and our receiver, and the antennas on those are a certain height from our very flat ground. And so there's two paths for our signal. The first is line of sight, and the second one is reflecting up off the ground. And so the question is, what's the impact of having these two paths on our received power? Okay. So again, we'll characterize our received power in time in terms of our normalized power at some distance E0. Okay. And the difference in power of the received signal is going to be dependent on the phase shift of one signal relative to the other. Okay. So we're going to have to sort of try and get a handle on that. The easiest representation is as a complex exponential. So we're dealing with the real part of a, e to the j, 2 pi f. And then we have our time-varying portion, and our phase can be represented as a sort of a fixed distance. So the phase is characterized as minus 2 pi f tau, for some tau, and then tau can further be characterized in terms of the distance. Okay, so we get this, where our phase is minus 2 pi f d over c. Okay. Now, we've lost our equation down here. Let me think about how I get that back. Not sure I can. Okay. So what we have down here, which is blocked by the Camtasia, is that our amplitude is again p d0 times d0 squared, or we can pull out p d0 and d0 squared. What we're left with then is our factors. We have a distance, and then we have our phase differential, so our phi term. Okay. And this no longer applies. Okay. So we get that. This is what was at the bottom. The top equation there is what was at the bottom of our previous slide. So again, we have what we need to do is say something about the relative distances of the paths, and then the phase differential of the paths. Okay. So what are the distances? Questions over there? So what are the distances that we're dealing with? Okay, so our D1, our line of sight, is directly from antenna to antenna. And again, you can see that if we just pull over the antenna height, you have H1 minus H, you get a right angle triangle, with one side being H1 minus H2, the other side being D, and so D1 is the square root of the square of the sum of the squares of those sides. Now, similarly, if we were to We have our second path, our reflected path. If we think about rotating this around the axis and continuing this on, well, again, we'll get a right triangle between with one side being D, one side now being H1 plus H2, and D2 then is the square root of the sum of the squares of the two sides. Okay. So the first observation we make is that if we're dealing with a large distance relative to the heights of the antennas, then we can accurately approximate D1 and D2 as just D. And so that allows us to pull out, we put D in there, we pull out our D squared term, and we're left with the difference between the two phases.
Sorry, what's the D, two D's, D1 and D2?
And D1 is the distance along our line of sight path. D2 is the distance along our reflected path. Okay. So we've now pulled out our D's, and we're comparing the phis, and we just multiply, add an E to J phi. One here, we end up with 1 minus e to the j delta phi. Okay. So what that's saying is that our power gain or drop is going to be dependent on the difference in the phase, which again, this shouldn't be surprising because you know that you're summing up the two angles. Okay, so we need to say something about the difference in the phase. And again, we can characterize that in terms of distance traveled. So we need to calculate what the difference between the distances traveled is. And so the way to do that is to, again, we want to take our basic formulas for D1 and D2. Then we do a Taylor expansion on them. Okay. And so this is the first two factors in the Taylor expansion. Further factors would have higher quantities of d squared, so we can disregard them. Sorry, higher powers of d, so they're going to be, again, if d is large, they're going to be small, so we disregard them. Okay, so we just take the difference between these two, and we get that's 2h1h2 over d. Okay. We plug that in, and we get a value for then delta phi. So just plug it in here. Okay. So we have that value of delta phi. And so we just need to know how it impacts on our e to the j delta phi. But again, we're assuming this d is large relative to h1 and h2. That means delta phi is small, and we can approximate e to the j delta phi as 1 minus j delta phi. Plugging that in, you get the absolute value of delta phi squared now. And again, plugging that in, you end up ultimately with a d squared factor from our initial equation, and then a second b squared due to the interference. Okay, and so we now have that our signal is deteriorating as distance to the power of 4. Okay. So, again, what do we take away from this? Well, again, we've had an impact on the power received, and if you get multiple paths, what you get is that some of them are increasing the amplitude, some of them are decreasing the amplitude, so you end up getting sort of, again, some factor, but it's somewhat difficult to predict exactly what. The second thing to note, because it'll occur later in the lecture, is that it's all dependent on our phase differential. Okay, so that was an example with two paths. Again, if you're not sitting on a flat surface somewhere out in the desert, but you're in a city or where the terrain is hilly, you have many more paths than that to consider, and in general it's going to be quite complex. So for the purposes of trying to do a sort of any sort of planning, models have been developed which are based on empirical data, and we'll have a look at a few of these models just to give you an idea of sort of what thinking is behind these models. Okay, and so typically what it is you have you again observe sort of a very specific set of locations. So our first model is the Lee model. It's fairly simple. It's based on data taken all around the LA area. Again, I don't know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, something, well, 20 years ago probably now. The Akamura model is based on data taken around Tokyo. And so Tokyo, again, as a city, has certain characteristics. It's got lots of buildings, but they're not that high. The Hata model is just an attempt to sort of make, sort of have a more mathematical or more formulaic, I should say, characterization of the Akamura model that's easier to use. Okay, so these models are frequently used. The thing to keep in the back of your mind, again, is that they're based on data sets for very specific locations. And, you know, if not, you've got to be a bit careful if you try to generalize that. For instance, if you try and generalize the Akamura model to New York City, which is all skyscrapers, it's not necessarily going to work. Maybe it would work better to generalize it to Dublin, which again is a very fat, flat city with lots of buildings. Okay, so we'll just go through these models. I would never expect you to know exactly what the formulas are, but again, I want you to have some idea of what factors influence the models and how they work. Originally established. Okay. And so, again, it's a bit of curve fitting, you've got empirical data, and you're trying to isolate out a few factors that affect the data, and then characterize them mathematically. And so for the Lee model, and again, we should note that it's also at a fixed frequency, or the data was taken at a fixed frequency. For the Lee model, there's three factors. There's the distance, again, and we shouldn't be terribly surprised to just see some multiplier factor. There's the frequency, so we have a fixed frequency, and then if we want to vary it, again, we say that there's some factor by which we can vary that. And then a fairly complicated correction factor. Okay, and so the first thing to note is that the P0 and gamma zero are again selected empirically, depending on the environment. And so again, we started with LA, and then we're going to try and correct for different characteristics. Okay. Now, F0 is again a correction factor and that correction factor has a number of components. And we'll see these again in the rest of the models pretty much. They have to do with the antenna gains, the antenna heights, and the actual power of transmission. Okay. And so, and N, again, is sort of a fudge factor that depends on the topography of your system, and we take N to be 2 for suburban and rural areas, or 3 for urban areas, and again, with some frequency dependence as well. Okay, so again, what we did, or what was done, was you looked at one city, and then you tried to see how that could be generalized, the information there could be sort of more generally applied to other areas. The Okamura model is sort of more widely used than the Lee models. The Lee model is sort of more representative. It's based on the same sorts of ideas as the Lee model, and is based on measurements for Tokyo. Okay. And so, again, it tries to characterize the power loss within a given frequency range, a given distance, antenna heights, etc. Okay. And it characterizes attenuation relative to free space using a series of curves, and then you sort of have to find your point on a curve. Okay. And so we have obviously our free space loss term, and then again a number of corrective factors a number of corrective factors to try and get, again, lost representation. Okay. So, again, we have the factors that are relative to the height gains. We have attenuation based on frequency and distance, and then we have area gain due to the type of environment. So we have essentially the same factors showing up for this model as we had for the Lee model. Okay. And so again, the attenuation, there's an attenuation factor relative to free space based on frequency and distance, and that gives us again a series of curves, and we have our correction factor based on different types of terrains. Okay. And then just the fairly simple height gains for the antennas. Okay. The formula is simple enough, but it feeds into, or feeding into it is various height gain factors, which again are fairly complicated curves. Okay. So what we see there is that we get potentially, it's argued that it's a more realistic, a more detailed representation of the of various systems. It's somewhat problematic in the sense that you have to refer to all these different tables in order to get your final result. And again, it has to be used with care when trying to generalize it to places other than the one on which the data was initially based. Okay, so we have an example here, and we've picked our distance and our antenna heights. We fix it to an urban environment and a base power. Okay, and assume no antenna, and we assume no antenna gains. Okay. So based on that, we can calculate our free space loss. And then again, you have to go to the curves to find our A value. Again, you need to go to the curves to find these values as well. These are based on the heights. And then our area gain. Okay. So again, we can calculate a specific power ratio doing that. Okay. So the main problem again with that approach is just that it's fairly complicated. And so the last model we'll mention is the Hatta model. And essentially what the Hatta model does is it replaces the plots created by Akamura with formulas. Okay. And so it tries to account for different terrains again. and different heights, etc. Okay. So we have our antenna height factors and adjustment factors as well. So, again, the aim of all these models is to try and be able to predict in some reasonable fashion the attenuation of power between base station and mobile station. And what we see is that there's a number of factors affecting that, the frequency, the antenna heights, roughly what you're trying to do is characterize the terrain within that, of course. And so it gives some way of, again, mathematically representing all of that. And there's loads of other models to consider as well. Now, again, what you want to walk away from all this appreciating is, sort of again, the complexity of these models and the difficulty and the fact that, again, if you're standing at any specific point in a city, they sort of may or may not apply because things do change reasonably rapidly. But, for planning purposes, they can be fairly good to give you basic numbers with which to work. Okay. So, everything so far has been about, again, what's called large-scale fading. It's been, you have an antenna, and at a large some distance away, you have your base station, and a distance away you have your mobile station. And just because of this large distance, you have various attenuation factors. The next topic that we're going to look at is what's called small scale fading. And what this says is that the factors we've looked at, if you step from here, take one pace of a step, it's not really going to change any of the factors we talked about previously. Now we're going to look at factors where if you move short distances, you can radically affect the values of your signal. Okay, and the power of your signal. This is referred to as small-scale fading, and what we're going to do now is take a break, breathe a sigh of relief, and when we come back in about 15 minutes, we'll talk about small-scale fading and how motion over short distances can impact on the quality of your signal. Okay, so 15 minutes or so, and we'll take that up.